This is the official EFL podcast.
Hello again and welcome to the official EFL podcast, a special edition of the show today. Wickham manager Gareth Ainsworth joins me. Gareth, we're here first of all to celebrate 7th anniversary of managing Wickham. You know, congratulations. What does it mean to you to have that reputation of being the second longest serving manager in the league now? You don't look that old.
Thank you, yeah. And thanks for having me on. Yeah, it was... It snuck up on me a little bit. I mean, I remember 5-year anniversary, obviously 2 years ago, and our head of media was nice enough to get me a message from Pochettino. Tottenham, we'd played him in the FA Cup that year, and that was nice from him. And believe me, that feels like a couple of weeks ago. It's gone so quick. It really has gone quick. It means a lot. Of course it does. You know, it means that, one, I've done an okay job because I'm still in a job. In the early days, I've always admitted that probably the club might not have been able to sack me because we had no cash, we had nothing really, and I was sort of learning the job as well. So that was lucky, and I think that was sometimes you've got to be fortunate. But I'm hoping the last sort of definitely 5 seasons we've gone from a steady curve upwards, and I've sort of justified my staying in the role. It's been great, you know, and obviously, you know, I know I'm the second longest in the 92 professional managers, and that's something really proud. I'm really proud of that. It's you know, when you're sort of 60th, 50th, it doesn't mean too much, but when you start hitting that top 10, it's always nice. But I've got a great friend in Jim Bentley, who's number one. So if I ever get the number one, I know it's not great for Jim. Number two is fine for me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you if you knew who the number one was, but clearly you do. Good friends with Jim. You mentioned it there, but is it something you are really proud of to have that record? We obviously see managers in terms of the careers, they go from one club to another, step up, step down, in case of sacks. Is that continuity? Is that something that managers strive for, do you think?
I think you want to stay in the job as long as you can. Now, some managers have had the job and then they've moved clubs because they've gone to the Championship, the Premiership from our levels, and so they're still in a job. They haven't been out of football. It just resets their time at one club. So, you know, there is probably some managers out there who've moved around and they've probably been a manager longer than me. So what I'm proud of is that what I've built at Wickham Wanderers, you know, and having the continuity of one club is what I'm proud of. But I'm not going to be a hypocrite. You know, if the Premier League, by the grace of God, came for a young English manager, which doesn't very often happen. I don't think it's happened for a long time. Of course, I'd want to move on, and I think everyone will give me their blessing here to go, yeah, go, and that would reset my clock. So I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say this is all I want to do. I want to manage at the highest level. My preferred option is to keep doing it with Wickham Wanderers. There's constraints on that, obviously, but I'm really proud that what we've built here now, I kind of look around the training ground and look around the stadium, in fact, sometimes, and see the stamp that not just me, but my staff, the fans under me and all the players under me, I can see a mark of what we've achieved and what we've done and how it's sort of built this club. And the story is a nice one, you know. We've had 7 years of, 5 years at least of an upward curve, but the first two were quite tough years.
Yeah, we'll come back onto that towards the end of the interview. I want to go to the start of your career now. You know, it began... Well, more or less 30 years ago, you began your career as a schoolboy with Blackburn Rovers, your hometown team as it was then. Just remind us what you were like as a player back then. How much have you changed since then?
Oh, wow. As a player back then, I was brought up in Blackburn, you know, and a hard-working family, you know. Dad had a lot of jobs to keep the family, and you know, I hardly ever seen him, and I think that instilled the work ethic in me that I've always had, you know, and I think that's a good thing. I went back to Blackburn recently, and people say, you know, you were tough on the pitch, and sometimes I realise why I was, you know, because Blackburn's not an easy place to grow up sometimes, you know. You've got to be quite streetwise, you've got to be, you know, it's a northern working class town, and it's, you know, it's definitely a million miles from the silver spoon stuff that some people experience. But yeah, the hard work and seeing the family. Mum was out at work. We were both latchkey kids, me and my brother, you know. So we had to let ourselves out in the morning, let ourselves in after school, you know. There was no one there to be there because we had to, they were out earning the money to pay for everything. So I think that instills your work ethic. And as a player, I think I had that. I had that work ethic. I loved working hard, whether it was tracking back and tackling a fullback or a winger from the other side, or whether it was getting forward, or if there was a loose ball there, no matter what minute it was, I always found the energy to go and chase it and go for it, you know. And I think that if for me, everyone can do that physically. It's a mental thing for me, you know, and I say that to my players. The mental side of the game is so important now. It's the desire to go and chase that loose ball or that rubbish ball over the top that your teammates somehow managed to mess up, still go and chase it. It's a desire thing and a mental thing rather than a physical thing. We're all fit and everyone's really fit and healthy and can run all day nowadays. But that desire sometimes, I think I was lucky to have that growing up. It was instilled in me from an early age. And I was never a schoolboy anywhere either, so I never was in an academy, these fantastic academies you have nowadays. Blackburn had one, I think it was back, School of Excellence they were called there, and all schoolboys from the ages of 8 and 9, they were at these Blackburn Rovers or Preston North End, all these local clubs. And I was never one of them. I took a while to get into the school team, never mind the any other team. I think my first 2 years at senior school, I didn't get in the team. I was quite shy. I was a bit of a warrior. I was, you know, a little bit of a, how am I going to get home after the game? How am I going to get to the game? And I think that sort of came in my later years, sort of 13, 14. I started physically being quicker than most people. One thing is, I always had my speed, and luckily still got that, which I'm sure we'll come to in a bit, which still get the boots on. But I was quick. I had this ethic to work and the competitiveness, the competition of a game I loved. I loved going up against somebody and trying to beat them, trying to get past them, trying to beat them as a team, individually. And I remember I had trials for Blackburn Rovers in my last year at senior school, so fifth year. I can't remember what it is now, year 11, I think they call it. So I had a trial in about the February. Played about 5 or 6 games for them, and players like David May and Jason Wilcox played in my first trial game at Blackburn Rovers, so super names nowadays, but obviously back then they were trying to forge their careers. And I remember playing Carlisle United in what was the A team, and I scored a hat-trick in my first game. I always remember it. And then going on to play in all the local teams, Crewe and a team called Marine from Liverpool, which toughened you up, believe me. And all these teams did well. And in about the April, really late in the football season, a guy called Jim Fennell, who was the youth team manager at Blackburn, rang mum and dad up. And I remember after one game, they stopped the car and they said, "Look, Blackburn have offered you a 2-year apprenticeship," which is an absolute dream come true. I was a Blackburn fan, season ticket holder, used to sit on the riverside, loved Blackburn Rovers, that was my team. Simon Garner's my hero, well, ultimately went on to play for Wickham as well. But I remember that day, I remember stopping the car and saying, "Look, you've been offered a 2-year apprenticeship." I think £29.50 was the first year's wages, but
it's changed.
Yeah, it's changed a little bit now from 16, 17 year olds. But that was a dream come true, really was a dream come true of having a chance at being a professional footballer. Knew I'd have to go in and clean the boots and all that come with that in those days. But yeah, it was a proud moment. And going back into school and trying to focus on the GCSEs was a bit tougher, but managed to do okay in them and started in the July for Blackburn Rovers as a first year apprentice, which super, super proud.
Yeah, I can tell by your face now, you're looking back and you can remember those days. But how difficult was it on the flip side when they did let you go, hometown team? That must have been tough to take.
Yeah, Don McKay was the manager there, and we did 2 years as an apprentice. You clean the boots and everything, you meet all these, Frank Stapleton, Colin Hendry, all these household names. So an amazing experience. But on my 18th birthday as well, it was on May the 10th, I am. So that coincides with a lot of talks at a lot of football clubs of, "Are we keeping you or releasing you?" And it's no exaggeration, right on my 18th birthday, it was brutal to hear. And I'm not big enough to admit I cried. I did cry that day. You know, I held it together at the club, held it together coming out of the office. And you had that feeling, you know, in the stomach where you know you're going to cry, but you have to hold it together in front of your mates, trying to be a bit cool. The moment I was on my own, absolute tears. It was everything to me. It was my club, my hometown. It's my first taste of rejection, really. I sort of say thank you, because that forged me again to be stronger, as well as a unbelievably supportive family of mum, dad always saying, you'll make it, you know. The emotion's getting stirred up talking about it again. So it was a tough time, but my dad backed me, and we wrote loads of letters to all the local clubs, and I think I went to train with Preston North End, and that was the start of something. It wasn't the start of a contract. Went to train with Preston. No room for me there, but Northwich Victoria, who's the manager, was Sammy McElroy, rang up, said, we need a right winger. He had some connections at Preston. And they put me to Northwich, played, I think, about 3 months at Northwich, did well, conference this is. And Preston rang me up on a Thursday night and said, do you want to come and play for the first team on Saturday? We've got no right winger. And I said, I haven't even got a contract. And he said, no, we'll sort that out after. Come and play in the game. I don't think you can even do that nowadays. But I think I signed a form to register me to play in the league. But I played for nothing. No contract, nothing.
You meant that much?
Meant that much to me. And I think anyone would, you know. I think anyone would. I could ask a guy in the street to play for me, you know, a guy in non-league, and say, look, we can't pay you, but do you want to play a first team game? Maybe the agents nowadays would go, whoa, you're not playing unless you get something. And that's probably killed a bit of fairy tale. But I had no agent. I had nothing. I had no football experience. But I played at Gay Meadow away on a Saturday at Shrewsbury. And we lost 2-1. But on the Monday, I think the headlines in the paper were, I'd done well, give him a contract. So they gave me a 6-month contract from January to May. And that was the start of my professional football career. Really proud then. I mean, I played professional football in front of crowds on the plastic pitch at Deepdale. So First club was Preston officially, and can't thank them enough for what they did.
Yeah, living the dream then.
Absolutely.
How much did it, looking back now, to play, you know, men's professional football in those early days as a teenager, how beneficial was that for you in the long run, looking back at your career now?
Playing at that age, I think I was 18, coming up 19, and I was playing men's football. I played against some decent names in those early days, Norman Whitesides and John Barnes and Paul Gascoigne's. They were all playing in the reserve leagues and some leagues. And then when I played at Preston, some tough league. I think we were League One then, League One players. And you had to grow up quick, you know. But I always had that pace. I always had that directness and that pace going forward, that it was almost, catch me if you can. If you catch me, you're only going to clip me, and it's going to be a foul. But I never really had any big, serious stuff. You know, it was great. It was on the wing, out the way, and it was me against the fullback, and that's how I used to see the game. It's a lot different now how I see it, but that was me against the number three. It was then. See how many crosses I could get in. That was about the size of playing for Preston. But it was great. I got released at the end of that year, but luckily enough, a scout called Glenn Burnell, who worked for John Beck at Cambridge, had spotted me. So when Les Chapman released me at Preston North End, again, not as many tears maybe, but I had a phone call pretty soon after from Glenn Burnell saying, look, John Beck, go down on trial at the end of the season. They were still playing. Cambridge were in the playoffs for the Premier League in 1992. So the first Premier League that was being formed, people won't remember this, Cambridge United were in those playoffs. I think Leicester won it, but Cambridge were in there to get in the Premier League.
And they were doing really well at the start of that season. They were top of the league for long periods.
Yeah, Dublin and you know, these big names. And John Beck, so I went down for a trial at the end of the season. Again, a little bit of fortune, I think. Did well in my trial. And they said, look, we'll offer you a contract next year. So I've gone from Preston North End, League One, released, to now Championship, Cambridge United, contract. And it was phenomenal. I got a year's contract from John Beck. And that's when my career really did start. That was the start, because somebody actually wanted me, somebody had seen me play, and John Beck had a big effect on my career as well.
Yeah, coincidentally, I spoke to Gary Rowett the other week, and obviously he was part of that that team as well. Under John Beck, he has great admiration for him, says he's brought a lot into his management. He takes a lot of inspiration from John Beck. Do you take the same amount of inspiration, or even more?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have played in the Premier League if it wasn't for John Beck. I can 90% say that, because he told me what I was good at and worked on it, and tried to add what I was bad at. Instead of concentrating on all the faults I had and spending lots of time correcting them and probably never getting anywhere because I've got a horrendous left foot and I've always have had. But he worked on my strengths. He told me what I was, what he wanted me to be and how I could get there. And he motivated some real amazing team talks and amazing methods he had with. We were doing ice baths after games, we were eating after training, and this is 1992, you know, this is, and it sounds silly now, eating after training. Some clubs didn't eat after training, they didn't have food, they didn't have either the facilities or the drive or the knowledge to that magic hour after training you have to replace. It was carbohydrates, it was fluids on board. He had his cold showers, of course, after long away trips, and he had his methods of playing. But as a winger, wow, you can play for a better method of management because the tactic was get it to the wingers and get crosses in. That was my game. That's what I loved. And so he brought that on. And I remember making my debut for him in about October-ish for Cambridge against Bristol City. And Andy Cole was playing for Bristol City. So this is going well back, Chris Kamara. And Andy Cole scored. And then we scored. I can't remember who scored for Cambridge. But I think in the last minutes of the game, well, no, I scored the winning goal from a corner. And the only thing I remember, the vivid memory, is mum and dad weren't there. They went to a show in Newcastle. It was one of the first games they'd ever missed. And it was. I think they rang my brother, and my brother said, "Have you heard the news?" And they said, "No, what's happened?" I went, Cambridge won 2-1, and Gareth scored the winner. So, you know, amazing to do that. But
that's did you forgive your dad for that?
You know, he's missed a few games. He missed another one, actually, ironically, in Newcastle when he scored me Premier League goals. But he's only missed two, I think, in about 600, but the two pivotal ones. But you know, he's always been there. And but back to Cambridge, that was a start of what I, you know, what I became, that player, that sort of professional footballer. And then John Beck got the sack. Unbelievably, gets the Preston job. And I was one of his first signings. I think it was on Christmas Eve, going back to Preston, and somebody actually paying money for me. I think it was about a couple of grand, but to pay money for me, I thought, this is it. Somebody's actually paid for you to be a footballer somewhere. You probably have made it now. So anything else could have gone wrong, but I'd always had that transfer, and somebody wanted me, and it was John Beck back to the Plastic on Deepdale. But no, really pleased, got back to Lancashire again. Being a young lad, it was great to be back home and played a good few years at Preston then, and really enjoyed it. You know, played some great games, and got to Wembley in our second season in the playoff final, ironically against Wickham, and playing against one of my heroes, Simon Garner, who scored against us that day, and just becoming this name, that this right winger that was okay in the lower leagues.
What was it like as well when you mentioned Cambridge? To move away at such a young age to somewhere like that, you know, you mentioned earlier about you being not the most confident of lads growing up.
Yeah.
You know, having to move away as a young player then, did that sort of make you as well as a footballer coming into your career now? I think, give you that confidence?
I think it's important. I remember, honestly, going to the cinema one night in Preston, and I'd been released by Preston, and Colin Endrew was at the cinema as well. You probably won't see professional footballers like that now at the cinema, but he was there. And I remember speaking to him and said, "Cole, like, I've been let go of Preston." And he actually said, I remember the words he said to me was, move out of your house. He said, get some independence. He says, that'll bring you on. And that was true. He said that to me. And I never really acted on that, on those words. But then when I did get the move to Cambridge, and I went and I've come back, and I'm thinking, you know what? He was right. Because when I did move away, I was looking after myself. I had to... you know, get me on food. I was in digs with the family, so there was a meal on the table every night. But I had to make sure it was the right stuff. I had to, you know, look after my own car, you know, my own clothes. And it's big, you know, moving out of house, you know, when your mum has done majority of stuff for you. And I think everyone can relate to this. It's big. And I think standing on your own two feet unconsciously affects up here. And you've got to mature. You've got to get there. And I'm not going to lie, I still talk to my parents nearly every day. And you know, my dad still plays a big part in my life. I talk to him at least four or five times a week. You know, I think we're still very close, and I've got a son. I'm hoping one day that carries on. But it was tough. Yeah, it was tough. It's three and a half hours away, Cambridge. It's not like an hour a week and just make the trip. It was quite a way. And with John Beck as your manager, he made it pretty tough as well. You know, we worked hard. We were shouted at. We were screamed at. Motivated, but it did mature me as a person, definitely. And I think going back to Preston was a different Gareth Ainsworth than left Preston previously.
Mm. And did that help you on your move to Lincoln, which followed then, having that experience of living away, obviously, somewhere?
Old hat then. A move, Becky again, you know, he got the Lincoln job, so he left for Preston North End and his assistant took over, and I sort of fell out of the team a little bit. And John, I remember he took Glenn again with him. Glenn gave me a call and said, you know, John fancies you again. Do you want to come? And I said, yeah, I'd love to come. I want to play football again. Now, Lincoln City were rock bottom of League Two at that time. John Beck had just taken over and taken Stevie Holmes and Barry Richardson, two of the players who'd been at Preston with me and who I'm still friends with today. But that was my first decision of, ooh, they're bottom of League Two here, you know, I'm going from a club here, but I wasn't playing at Preston. But again, you know, you go, oh, bottom of League Two. But I think when you're young like that, 22, 23, I think I was, you don't fear anything. You have no fears. You just go to play football. And once the boys were there, I went into Lincoln for talks with my dad, who did all my talks with me. And John sold the place to me and said, look, you're going to be playing. You know, this place is crying out for you, and look at this, what we've got, this town. It's a beautiful city, you know. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's not many motorways near there. Believe me, that was a hard place to get to. But I made it home, bought my first house there, and made Lincoln my home for 2 years and loved my time there. Fans were great, people were great, and I think it showed on the pitch. It was probably the most productive 2 years of my career.
Yeah, did you believe that's when your career did really take off? I think you won the league player of the year in your position whilst
playing. Yeah, I got in team of the year, which they do at the end of the year, which all your peers vote for, which again is a great thing for any footballer to have, and player of the season a couple of times the 2 years I was there, and I think top goal scorer as well. I missed out on the golden boot to Graham Jones, I think it was, who was at Wigan, banging him in that season. So all seemed to click. And the team spirit we had there was just phenomenal. You know, we had a real, real good team spirit because of John. I'm glad I was young and single, because I don't think I could have been older and married with kids trying to keep up with that team spirit. It was pretty crazy. It was, and I played for some good team spirits with QPR and Wimbledon and that. But Lincoln City, those years, they can rival that. They were pretty crazy guys. But we partied hard together, but we played together on that pitch. We were a family, and I think the fans took us all to their hearts, and you know, we stayed up quite comfortably, nearly made the playoffs the next year. And then the next year, I'd left, I got my move to Port Vale, and that team got promoted. But John had been sacked, I think, middle of that season before they got promoted. But really, it was his team, that spirit, that got them up. It was a shame to see him go. But again, I can't thank him enough for my journey back into the Championship with Port Vale.
Yeah, and you mentioned there the move to Port Vale. Again, paid money for you, so quite big money at the time for the division that we're in. And you excelled there. What was that move like for you, you know, going back-to-back clubs where you were relatively successful?
Yeah, I loved Port Vale again. You know, John Rudge was there. So probably John Rudge took me at a time when it was perfect. He was quite opposite to John Beck. He was very calm, calculated. He'd been in charge of about 18 years at Port Vale then. He'd been a very long-serving manager. And to this day we speak, you know, still he's highly regarded. I only had a year there, but he got the best out of me. You know, he got the best. I think Becky told me what I was, knew how to get the best out of me, and then John just took it to the Championship level where it's different, of course. There's better players, bigger pitches, some fantastic games. You know, look at the Championship nowadays, and wow, it's a heck of a league, you know. And back then, Port Vale being in the Championship was very proud. You know, they had some great seasons. I think one season they Stoke and Man City went down and we stayed up, which says, you know, the stature of the club at that time. You know, it was a very, very good place to be. And like I say, it was only a year, but I learned a lot. I think I learned then about more about football, not about me. John Beck was about me and how I was and the best to get out of me. I think I started looking then slightly at systems and how we play, but still I was this very sort of give me the ball and I'll get past the fullback player. But I had some, you know, some good games at Port Vale and some memorable occasions, you know, Arsenal in the FA Cup and yeah, some real good times. So but then moved to what was my dream, and that was to try and make the Premier League. It'd been quite a quick rise after Lincoln, but to get a move to the Premier League was just everything I'd ever dreamed of.
Yeah, but one of the most difficult times of your career, I'm guessing, was that tackle on Dane Whitehouse against Sheffield United for Port Vale at the time. Of course, ended his career. How difficult was that for you, having known that afterwards and the sort of fallout from it?
Yeah, it wasn't nice, you know. It was obviously, I don't regret things, but if I had that tackle again, I'd probably pull out of it, because you don't want to end anyone's career, you know. It was I'm a young lad, he's a young lad, we're both fighting and scrapping, and you know, you see plenty of them in the game now. Some tackles, I think I've touched the ball but gone over the ball and hit him, and it was the aftermath then, you know, the knowledge that I think his cruciate had gone, and back in those days they were more difficult to fix than now, and him not playing again, you know, just like I said, never ever mean any harm to anyone, never have done, but obviously took some rap for that, because he was a promising young player at Sheffield United, and yeah, still take plenty of stick now, but you know, just wished it hadn't, you know, ended his career. It was a ball there to be won and full-blooded challenge, but no way was there any malice ever. And that's probably why I can't hold my head up, but still, you never want anyone to finish playing because of an injury.
How has that stayed with you throughout your career?
Do you know, I've always been one who can sort of look in the mirror and know I never meant to hurt anyone or do anything bad to anyone, and I've never done that. It's the way I've been brought up is to be, you know, be tough and get stuck in, but you know, you treat everyone how you want to be treated, and that's so that, you know, it was hard. And
I heard you even wrote a letter to him, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we wrote a letter after the challenge. I know he'd gone in hospital for an operation. I wanted to write and obviously say, you know, apologies, all the best, and get well soon. But it was further down the line that he found out he wasn't going to play again. I think he tried a couple of times to come back, and yeah, gutting. I always get stick when I go to Sheffield United, you know. I know it's football, but again, it's something that, like I said, I don't regret's a strong word, but if you could have a time machine sometimes and go back, I'm sure everyone's got two things they'd go, yeah, I might just not have done that, and that's one of mine. But like I said, never meant to do anything, never meant to end anyone's career, so I can still go, you know, that's it does happen in football, and I can still, you know, look in the mirror and know that.
I suppose, you know, it's just unfortunate for everyone involved.
I know. And, you know, I'm sure he could have gone to be a good player, great player. You never know what's going to happen in life, what path we're on. And like I said, I had my fair share of injuries, but touch wood, never ended me. I had a serious one at Wimbledon that I thought was going to end me. So I know, you know, I can sort of sympathise on the toughness of an injury, a long-term injury, and get it back in. So, yeah, tough times. But again, never really, like I said, I didn't let it affect me too much, because it's something I didn't mean. It was an accident, and that's how I look at it today.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, because you're a player that didn't sort of have that side to you as well, it's probably, I'm guessing, it weighs more on your mind because of that.
Yeah.
Like you say, you didn't have that tension.
Always tough, you know, always tough. I always wanted my fullback or my players to know that they've been a tough game, you know, and I think I remember Gary saying on the TV, Gary Rowett, the other day, he was asked about my career, what do you remember, Gareth? And he said, oh, I just remember people strewn on the pitch when they played against him, because I'd get up, I'd challenge, I'd tackle, I never pulled out of anything, and I always tell my boy now, don't pull out of anything, you'll end up getting hurt, you know, so he's full-blooded as well, but like I say, you know, that's just the way I was totally committed and never meant malice in anything. But unfortunately, there is that aftermath of that one. But no, it's still, playing today, I'd still get stuck in because that's the person I was, you know. That was what I was known for. I didn't have the silky skills that some players have got. Mine was all effort and commitment and desire. And yeah, it got me through who I am today.
Yeah. Again, we'll get back to the playing days, which is still going on a bit later in the interview. Let's bring it back to a more positive side of things there. You talked about your move to Wimbledon, earning that dream Premier League move at the time. When did you know that there was interest? And I've read in other places where you could have potentially moved elsewhere as well. Was it just Wimbledon who was interested? What was the situation?
No, there was a few clubs. I think Tottenham and Leeds were both very interested as well. Obviously, two huge clubs as well, you know. I know Joe Kinnear had been to the games to watch me a few times. I know George Graham had been to the games as well, you know. So it was, I don't think there were just rumours. You hear rumours and you hear rumours all the time. But I think when you actually see people there, you know, walking around the place and everyone was talking about where I was moving, not if I was moving, it was where I was moving. So you sort of get an indication. And it was sort of late 90s now, so agents were quite prevalent in the game. I think even Fulham with Kevin Keegan had a slight interest, and he was England manager, and people were saying, well, if you go there, you know, you never know what will happen. So it was, exciting times. But and again, because I was so young, you know, this is mid-20s, it's not, wasn't distracting, the fear of, is this the right move? I just want to get there, I don't care who it's with. I don't know exactly what happened, but I think Wimbledon were the only ones who would bid what they bid. And I think Port Vale took the highest bid, and that was the only team I was allowed to go and speak to, you know. So I remember driving down the motorway to London from Blackburn. I just actually bought a house in Newcastle-under-Lyme near Stoke. So I was living there, but Dad came down. We got in the car at Newcastle and both drove down to London for talks with Wimbledon because that's the club, I think, that had gone the furthest with the bid to acquire my services. And going down to London from a lad from Blackburn, it was quite an eye-opener. You know, I'd been down for school trips and maybe I think one holiday once, but driving down and meeting Joe Kinnear, Sam Haman, the owner at the time, and David Barnard, who is still a close friend today, was really interesting, pretty mind-blowing as well. It was when we're driving down the A40 past Madame Tussauds and Baker Street and all this, and they were pointing them all out, and I'm thinking, oh, this is a big place. So, but we had the talks, and great to agree terms. Wanted to play in the Premier League. It was all I've ever wanted to do, especially when I started kicking on a little bit. And ironically, the first game was against Blackburn, which I missed. I signed on the day or the day before, maybe, that Wimbledon were playing Blackburn at Sellers Park, and sitting in the stands watching that game. Can't even remember the score. I just remember meeting all the boys afterwards, and that was me then. And it's crazy as a footballer, you know, you're in your house one day on the Friday. I go down to Wimbledon, sign on the Saturday. I think I went home for the Sunday, got a few bits, and I'm in a hotel then for 3 months in Cobham, just off the A3 there. And I'm a Wimbledon player, and you just leave like that, and that's how football is, you know. You do just leave, and you don't know when you're going to get home next. They give you an odd day off here and there, but you're committed then to that club, that new club, and yeah, obviously, Premier League, it's not like it is now, and now is, wow, it's a superstar sort of celebrity thing now, and was getting there then, but, to play in some of those games and to play in that league was fantastic, and really proud to have done it.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, it being crazy. Obviously, it's the end of the crazy gang era, yeah. Of course. Just tell us about your initiation when you went to the club.
Yeah, I think on the day, one of my first days when I was there training, and we trained on this Richardson Evans down on the A3 there, and there's a little pavilion there where we all got changed and everything. And during the session, towards the end of the session, I think Robbie Earle and Effin Akoko, I think it was, both pulled up with injuries. I think Marcus Gale then pulled up with an injury, and I'm thinking, oh, fire, we're not going to have a team for Saturday here. They've all pulled up and they've all gone in the pavilion. And little did I know that was all planned. They'd all gone in the pavilion to set my clothes on fire. So next thing I know is the clothes I'd been warning in for training were hanging out the window in flames, and all my trainers had been cut up, and just, you know, I had to go home with my kit that day and made sure I didn't wear anything of, not that I had anything decent, but not too decent for the next few days until the next person signed. But it was, that was me. That was them saying, look, you're in our mate. We're going to do this to you, and you've got to join this group. Or, you know, I think if you kicked off against it, they'd have had you and they would never let it go. But I sort of accepted it. Said, you know what, I can give as good as I get, so I just watch your backs. And it was
experience at Lincoln probably helped.
Experience at Lincoln, yeah. I'm surprised a few things didn't go on at Lincoln. We didn't have as much money at Lincoln, so we couldn't start burning each other's clothes. But it was a good initiation. No, it was all a laugh. It was all done in jest and lightheartedness, and it was almost like, you know, don't think you've made it yet. Don't be too big time here. I was the record signer at the time for Wimbledon, which was again a proud moment, although John Hartson signed about 3 weeks later and blew my record out of the water, but he got the same treatment, so it was nice to see. But they were great bunch, real good bunch of guys, you know, and to move into that Premier League, you know, you don't know what to expect, but it was a good club to join. It was at the time, it was on the up. My only unfortunate thing was the injuries I mentioned earlier. You know, I got a groin injury that turned into a double hernia and this back and everything, and that kept me out for a good amount of time in the Premier League. And I think my appearances were very limited in the Premier League. You know, managed to score 2 goals up at Newcastle, which was amazing, and I'll never forget that day. And played some important days, Chelsea's and Arsenal's, and you know, Man United's coming to home and things like that. But never, I always feel like I never really put my stamp as much as I wanted to on the Premier League. And it's not a regret. Like I say I don't regret, but it's I wish that injury hadn't come at the time it did, because I hadn't missed a game for about 5 years before then. And, you know, I was a constant in the teams, but the injury really did. Put my Wimbledon career on the back burner.
Yeah, at the peak of your career probably then as well.
Yeah, you know, I felt like I could conquer the world. I felt like there's any fullback I could take on. You know, I remember playing against some real good fullbacks, Winterburns and Lesores and that, and getting past them, not every time. Obviously, it was a good battle, but it wasn't like I was totally out of my depth. You know, I remember, you know, getting good crosses in, scoring goals, you know, in training, feeling like I was part of it and feeling like, yeah, I can handle this level. It's where I was. I was always quick. I felt quicker than ever. I felt like I could really make this impact. And, you know, there was all the talk about the national sides and things like that and the B team watching me. And it was great. But, the injury really did put a stop on things, and that was tough. That was a real tough time, you know, being in the treatment room for a whole year. You know, one Christmas you're in there, and then the next Christmas you're still in there with the same injury. Just couldn't shake this groin thing off, and you know, some things happen for a reason. And we had a player here 2-3 years ago now, Scott Cashcott. I brought him in from Leighton Orient. Great little player, fantastic kid. He had exactly the same thing, and he was out for probably a whole season. So somewhere there may be a wicked irony that I had to go through it to help him get through it, you know, and he's flying now for us. But I know exactly what he's been through, because I was there, and it's the tough time, you know, tough time to keep focused. And I honestly did think my career was over. I thought I'd never play again. I had some serious dark moments, but, you know, there's no talk of the mental side of things that you hear about so much today. I had some moments where I thought that was it. I thought that was it. And what am I going to do now? You know. And I would have been fine. I'd gone back. I'd work anywhere. If anything happens, I'd go and find someone graft. But I thought that might be the career over. 26, 27 years old. But they actually, the physio, I think the new physio came in. A guy called John Clincard, who was working at Oxford, I think, at the time, and Steve Allen was there. And they got me right, those two. They sort of worked really hard on me. and it was all this pelvis and rotational things that you probably diagnose in a couple of weeks this nowadays and fix, you know. But then it was a real tough time for me.
You mentioned it there in terms of how it's dealt with now, the mental side of the game as well. How, when you're coming back from an injury like that, how much does it affect you mentally, your mental state, knowing, like you said, you thought your career was over?
Yeah.
I'm guessing you saw a lot of dark places in your head at the time, knowing the fact that, you know, what you've worked for your whole life could soon be about to end.
Yeah, but do you know what? I've always felt lucky. I've always felt privileged to be where I was. So my take on it probably would be more, all right, you got to 26 playing football, 27 playing football, and how many people get to do that? How many people get to play in the Premier League, you know? So my look would be like that, rather than this has all been taken away from me. It was tough when I was coming back and it was breaking down and it was the same injury again. That was tough going, I thought that was right and it's gone again. That was the tough moments. And thinking, all that work I've done in that treatment room and it's broke down again. But having a look at running down the wing at Preston and Lincoln and Port Vale and Wimbledon against you, Nigel Winterburns, against you, Ashley Coles, against people like that, wow, I'm lucky to have done that. Not many people have done that. So I'd look at it like that rather than going, oh, it's all been taken away from me. Because it hasn't, you know, I'm so lucky and I've still got plenty to going on, you know. So that's...
Does that sort of come down to your upbringing again?
I think so. You know, I've always been that way. I've always been... and I don't want to say I'm the most humble guy in the world, because I'm not. There's a lot more people, but I do try and keep, like, look at and be grateful for what you've got, you know, rather than try and want what everyone else wants, you know. And that's, it's hard to do sometimes, you know. It really is hard to do, but I do try and look at that way on things rather than the other side. So, and I think that it'd be great if we could work on some of our youngsters now in today's society, definitely, because I think there's that much social media. There wasn't social media then. There wasn't this is what you do, this is what you should be, this is what you should look like. It was all that you are who you are and you deal with it, you know, and that's... But now I think there's an element to strive to be this, and if you don't make it, then you're falling short, and that's hard to take. And I think that's big in society nowadays. I think that's got to be looked at, in my opinion, because... You know, we're quite a lucky society. We're quite lucky to be where we are, you know. And if you graft hard enough, you can get your rewards no matter what it's in. I was just lucky enough to be in football, and so I work hard with my players here to try and give them that aspect of things, and that's why we do our development days, and that's why we try and keep them really grounded, not too high, not too low. And my door's always open, and I'm always willing to chat and sympathise, empathise if I can, if I've been through it, to help these guys through it all. But yeah, it was tough, but it wasn't a depression thing or anything. It wasn't ever gonna finish me. It might have finished my football, but me as a person, I think I would have found something and gone in full blown into that. Lucky enough, like I say, I got back. The gutting thing was Wimbledon were relegated from the Premier League while I was injured. Played fits and starts, you know, double figure games, but never made the impact I wanted to make. And by the time I could, we were in the Championship, which I'd sort of done with Port Vale. So, you know, I knew I could do that. So I never really fulfilled that challenge, but I'm grateful to have been there and had the opportunity. Just my damn groins give up at the wrong time.
I mean, you touched on it there in terms of the pressures on modern players on social media and things like that. We see, like now with the EFL, with the partnership with mine, you see it on the shirt there with the squiggle, for example. How important do you think that could be, the raising of awareness for the players, the fact that they can have that support? That support is there for them if they need it.
And I think knowing the support's there is important. I think we need more of the support. I do think we need more, because some of these charities, I know they're overrun with people, and putting some more money into these charities, into this mental health, giving some of these youngsters exit strategies that deal with the rejection or the... So some of these players, they've been in football and they've been seriously immersed in football since 7 and 8 years old, and they get to 16 and they're told they're not good enough. Wow, that must be tough. That must be really tough, you know. Not for them. Parents have been saying, yeah, you're going to make it, and they don't. you know, that it's got to be some better exit strategies for these youngsters, I believe. Now, I'm just a voice as a manager, and we haven't even got an academy. But I see it with my son, you know, when he's been playing his football and growing up, and he's not in an academy, but I've seen parents push their kids to academies, driving here, there and everywhere, and some academies even charging the parents for their kids to be there. And I'm thinking, this isn't right. You know, and I'm not naming any academies. There's all sorts of academies, not just professional, non-professional, all these promises. And it's tough, you know, it really is tough, because there's so much competition out nowadays, so much competition. It was so much easier to make it when I was a kid than it is now. Just hope that we can work, we can see and work on these strategies for these young people who've had everything done for them, to when they do come across challenges, to be able to overcome them. And we've done some great work with some real good sports psychologists here. And so there is some good people out there, but it's just like you say, getting that word out there that MIND are out there, and not just MIND, but a host of charities to help people through, because of course it is, it's out there now, you know, we're more aware of it, and it's a big thing. And there was depression in my day, of course was, but it just wasn't recognised, and people didn't come out with it as much. They dealt with it in different ways. I think brilliant that people can come out and say it now, but they're dealing with it now. Let's try and raise that. And I'm saying that, I don't know how to do it, but I'm sure there'll be some money involved somewhere that we can help with.
Of course. Focusing back on your career now, though, you mentioned your time at Wimbledon, being injured during that season of relegation. You had obviously moved on after that. You had that short spell at Cardiff, was it? And then you moved back to London with QPR. Two goals on your debut. You know, you made yourself at home quite quick there, didn't you?
Yeah, I loved it. You know, QPR is probably the club I'm most known for playing for now. It's my biggest spell there. 8 years, loved it. Really, really enjoyed that place. You know, I got some real good friends. We had a great dressing room again, you know. It's similar to Wimbledon, similar to Lincoln. You know, Kevin Gallen, Martin Rowlands, Mark Bertram. We had a great team spirit, you know. And I was about, I think it was 30 years old when I signed for Rangers. So it was, I was full of confidence then. Gone are the days of this young lad with no confidence. I'd been through the mill, and probably the injury as well, and that almost gave me this you know, throw caution to the wind sometimes. Just enjoy it and be who you are. And I went into QPR, and the two goals on my debut helped obviously settle me in, and I scored a couple of crackers against Rushden and Diamond not long after that, which to this day people always come up and say I was there that day. There must have been 50,000 there, the amount of people that have said they were there. But it was special goals, special moments, and getting promoted at the end of that season under Ian Holloway, who again, pretty much a little bit like Becky-ish. He was a great motivator, made me aware of what I was, got me back on playing again, and really put me back on the map again. So again, I can't thank Ian enough, and the successive managers, John Gregory, Gary Waddock, and you know, people like that who came into QPR, and again, really started to enjoy my football again. Played a lot of games, a few injuries, but really enjoyed QPR and played there, I think, right up to about 37 before I came here. Some great times, and like I say, it put me as a London boy. You know, I've been down here too long now, but I can't see myself going home anytime soon. Not lost my accent, but definitely it kept me down south and kept me in London. And it was a real good club to be at.
Yeah. Did you fall in love with the area during your time at Wimbledon and QPR? Is that why you stayed down here?
Yeah, Wimbledon was tough, you know. Wimbledon was tough. I was a little bit more south, more right around the M25, Surrey area. And it was a little bit isolated and a long, long way from home, a long, long way, you know. And the tough times at Wimbledon, probably I didn't get as much out of that living down there. But when I went to QPR, we moved just... that's about 10 miles away from the ground, just outside the M25 there, and in Bucks, and it just felt like the right place at the right time. There's a lot of QPR fans about. There's a lot more QPR fans than I ever realised. You know, they're everywhere, all the west side of London. You know, they're all QPR people, and it was a real nice. It's a big club, big club. Even though they one of the smaller London clubs. It's a big club. I loved playing for QPR, and the support I still get today from Rangers fans is special. So that really felt like the right place at the right time. Then started my coaching career as well as my ending my football career. So again, a club that's very close to my heart.
Yeah, giving you a lot of opportunity with Ian Holloway as well. You mentioned him there, but how much influence did he have on your managerial career now?
Looking back, when I first went to QPR, I had no ambitions of being a manager and no ambitions of being a coach. I was still that guy who got the ball and right, I'll beat my left back and get a crossing for you. People would come in at half-time and talk about the game and this guy's rolling in here or they're overloading here. And I'd be like, I'm not seeing that. So as a player, being totally honest, I didn't really focus on too many on about what the opposition did, how we could break them down. It was just a case of, I'm a winger, I still what I do and know what I'm good at, and give me the ball, I'll try and get past people, I'll come in at the back stick and edit back across or try and score a goal. And I'll help you out in defence, you know, my work rate will be there for you. And then I think towards the end of my career at QPR, rather than the start of the career, I think looking back now, I take things from Ian, you know, his energy, the way he was about with us as well. He was a real energetic person and got us motivated through his leadership energy. You know, he was great at that. He was so good, such a bubbly character. But the tactics for me probably came a little bit later when I started talking to sort of, you know, John Gregory came in, Paulo Sousa came in, and Ian Dowie, you know, and a guy called Luigi Di Canio. And around those times, I was out of the team and I was older. And I probably thought to myself, you better start looking at something else here. And although still no ambition to be a manager, started looking at the game a bit differently, a bit older. And I think people mature at different rates. And mine was quite a late one for coaching and understanding the game. And I still don't understand the game, believe me, as much as some. But I think we're learning all the time. And again, I think that's a strength, admitting that I've still got plenty to learn. But when Luigi Di Canio came in, he couldn't speak great English. He was Italian. And I speak Spanish. My partner, she's Venezuelan. So I learned Spanish, not great Spanish. Don't ask me to be fluent on camera, because I'll say no. But enough to get by. So I could understand what Di Canio was saying to the boys. I'd translate it sometimes when his translator wasn't there. And then at the end of the season, he left, but he said to me, the boys respect you and you know what you're talking about and they're doing what you ask. Take your coaching badges. So really he probably will never get to see this video, but he was probably the one who's got me into that. And then Ian Dowie came in and I got reserved team manager's job, just real fledgling things. But then ended up getting the caretaker job twice as well because Flavio Briatore was in charge and he wasn't as loyal as Wickham have been with me, believe me. So he chopped and changed a lot and I got the manager's job twice as caretaker. Really wasn't ready at all, and I admit that now. But it gave me a taste of being in charge and we had some good games. I went to Man United was one of them, which was a crazy game. But and only losing 1-0 and having a drink with Alex Ferguson afterwards, you know. I made the decision then to go down the coaching route, do the badges, pursue what I got today. But it's quite late in the career to decide to want to do that. But I'm glad I did.
You mentioned Flavio there. just tell us about what it was like to work under him. A bit different to normal jobs.
I think the reports in some press are sensationalised. I think that. There was one report in that Man United game where I got back to my phone at half-time and there were 70 missed calls from him. That never happened, you know, so there wasn't those things. I think people would have loved to them things to have happened. But,
yeah. I think people saw the documentary.
He's very controlling. He had a lot of money in the club, and this club that was struggling a little bit, so he'd put some money in, he'd come in and he wanted to change things. He changed the aesthetics of it, you know, he changed lots about the club. And he changed a lot of managers. So I had to pick the piece that was the oldest pro. I'd have been changed probably if I wasn't on a player's contract, but he wasn't allowed to sack me. So it was a bit chaotic, but he never came in and picked the team. He'd, he'd pushed me towards some players saying, look, you know, we've paid a lot of money for this guy and he's come across for me, you know, I want to see him playing. And as a caretaker manager, you think, you know what, I'll pick the other 10 around him and try and do some formation. But there was no, I'll pick the 11 and you just go and take it. It wasn't like that. It was he was quite controlling, but he had a lot of other things on in his life, the motor racing and, you know, there was all sorts going on at the time. But it was a bit chaotic, if I'm honest, you know.
A very passionate man.
Yeah, very passionate man, you know. We had some interesting phone calls, believe me, but I keep them to myself. It was he was very passionate, put it that way. But really did set me up to think, it can't be harder than this. anywhere else, it was quite difficult. But again, it gave me the opportunity. I can't thank people enough for that. I was a caretaker manager in some big games in the Championship. And I was probably then looked at as being a potential coach for the future. And I knew I still had more playing to do, but I was on the badges sort of track then. I took my B licence, took my A licence, and started down that track of coaching. Still wanted to play though, still felt fit, and still really knew I had something to give. And when Gary Waddock, who was one of my ex-QPR managers, got the Wickham job, the offer was here to come and play for Gary 10 years ago now, so January 2010 I think I signed officially, and again it was the right move. Still had plenty of football left, League 2, but wanted to still show what I could do, and I think 2 years of playing one promotion, skipped the team to promotion that year in 11-12, and then ended up getting the manager's job, caretaker manager job, when Gary got dismissed, and still sitting here. But can't thank Gary enough, you know, real great guy. And on the day he lost the job, he was good enough to come and find me and said, your turn now, go make it happen. Rather than saying, I can't believe they sacked me, he went, your turn now, go make it happen, guys. And to this day, still speak to him, got a huge amount of respect for him, and you know, I'm glad he's still in management and coaching.
And like you said, almost 10 years now since you've been at the club. You must obviously like the place, and I guess we'll have to come back in a few months' time to do another interview with you.
I think in football, I think they like you more is important, you know. So that's, you know, of course you like the place, it's football. And I go back to saying I'm lucky. Wake up every morning, how lucky am I? I'm manager of 92 clubs, I'm managed one of them. And never take that for granted. I inspire people. I get the chance to tell people a strategy and try something on a Saturday. How good is that? And if it doesn't go right, you lose a game, but you don't lose your job. You lose it after a certain amount of games, of course, but we're still looked after, you know. We're still in a privileged position, and so it's great. It's great that I've got this support and this faith from this club, but I'll always give my all no matter where it is, you know. I said to Donna the other day, my missus, I said, look, I'd work in Starbucks if I have to, but it'd be the best Starbucks around, I tell you. I'd be motivated in there. So, but I'm really lucky, really happy to be the manager and keep inspiring players, these young players, these older players, keeping them going, you know, like in Fenways and Bloomfields and the like, you know, they're still going and still wanting to do it for me. And to have their respect, as much as these young kids who don't know me, just as the manager, they never know I played, but to have played with Matt Bloomfield, played against Akinfenwa, and to have their respect as a manager, that's just as much as anything, you know. It's a real nice thing to have, and like I say, I'll never take it for granted, and I give my absolute all.
Mm. And like we touched on earlier, when you started at the club, not the easiest time to take over. Obviously, for most jobs, it's never the easiest time to take over, is it? But a real difficult first few years in charge for you, wasn't it? If you don't mind me saying.
First 18 months, you know, yeah.
What was it like to be thrown in at the deep end like that? And how much did that experience at QPR help you?
I think that everyone's different. So I inherited Gary's squad, obviously. And everybody sees the game differently, and I saw it so naively compared to what Gary saw it. So I've come in, and immediately you're going to get an upturn because it's a new manager and it's a fresh run, and I'm full of energy. So that first 6-8 months, got away with it. We finished 16th, I think, or whatever it was. We were bottom at one stage, but it was nothing to do with coaching. It was nothing to do with picking the right team. It was to do with the energy and the togetherness and the change. The change, you always get a little bit of an upturn. Most clubs, you know, they get a little bit of an upturn, I think. And I got that, so I was lucky. Second season, wow, that was tough. That was really tough. I still had a squad that wasn't mine. There was 90 or 80% of the players I didn't sign. Some older lads, some ones I was leaving out. I don't know what the chat in the dressing room was, you know. And I'm in my first full year of football management. Not easy. No money. The club went to trust-owned, which meant that the fans then took the running of the club over. So there's no chairman to say, even if I had the knowledge of a £50,000 striker and I need him in to get us out of this terrible state we're in, it wasn't there. It was really, really tough, you know. It was picking up free transfers here, trying to get loans in from no contacts, either real contacts. You know, I'd had contacts in the game, but not as manager level. And that second season was really tough, really tough. And to survive with the skin of our teeth at Torquay away, I still say is my biggest learning curve, better than any course I've ever done, better than any book I've ever read. That season, that last 3 months of that season, that shaped me and toughened me up as a manager, made me make some proper decisions that a manager should make, rather than being this player that was energetic, that could get past people, that was always smiling, bubbly, lit the captain. But you couldn't do that in management. You have to change. You have to change. And I needed the authority. I needed the respect. I needed the more knowledge. And all those things were my doing, nobody else's. So that summer, I said, right, you either going to lose this job and never manage again, or you've got to make some serious decisions, some serious changes. And I think we signed 12 players in that summer or something, and made some cuts, made some serious decisions. Almost had a nothing to lose because we'd almost gone down. That helped. We'd almost gone down. Everyone thought, that's it, they're going down next year, definitely. The trust on, they're not going. Did I get lucky on some signings? Maybe. Joe Jacobs and Theodore John Barty, you know, they've been released by clubs. They come and they were fantastic. Paul Hayes, you know, awesome players. Alfie Mawson, we got on loan from Brentford. Didn't know much about him, really. What a player, you know. And, you know, I'd seen him play, thought, you know, he looks okay. Little did we know he'd go on to play, for, you know, sub for England last season, you know. So all these things went. Now, maybe I'd had plenty go against me the year before, but they all went, and I was able to then start thinking about tactics, thinking about the way I wanted to play. How do I want to be known as a manager? I've always had the energy and the passion and the claw, and my teams will work hard, but I needed a bit more, and I had to come up with a bit more. And tactically, we tried a couple of systems. I started working on training tactically, exactly what I wanted to see, rather than just putting the best team I thought together with a great spirit, go out there. You know, that was the difference. And for 5 years now, we've developed that and developed. And I'd like to think we've got better and kept those core values of never say die, and that should always be there, you know. It's the work rate, the togetherness, the team spirit, and it isn't always there, you know. Sometimes it's not always there, and I'm lucky enough to have a dressing room that runs itself. But yeah, I was very naive in them first 18 months. Learned a heck of a lot. Can't thank everyone for having faith in me. And hopefully I'm repaying some of that back now, because we've done a real good start to this season.
You certainly have. But coming back to that first initial stage of you taking over, it's a question I ask quite a lot of the people who I've interviewed, is what is it like for you personally, when you are sort of involved in the coaching setup, you know, a player, to come into the team and then to take over as manager, you know, whether it be caretaker manager or actual manager itself, how difficult is it to transition from that relationship, from being one of the part of the team, part of the squad, to being like, you're in charge now? Yeah, what do you do? Do you call the players? Call you have to call your gaffer?
No, that was one of the things. You know, they didn't do that until the 18 months down the line, and that was my decision. And it was like, oh God, I'm saying, call me gaffer.
Having to say that.
Is difficult. You know, you don't want to. But I thought, you know, it would be. I was Gaz. I was Gareth. I was mate. And I think you can't do that. You can't do that. One, for the respect. I think you've got respect in it. I had respect from what I was as a player, hopefully. And I'm hoping all that hard work and the graft and I'm putting as a player earned me a little bit of respect as a person. But I think it's the new players coming in, players who don't know you, you know, and I think having that focal point of the gaffer, where the decision stopped with the gaffer, I think is important, you know. I do think it's important. I don't know if other people, I mean, I'm sure that some of the people right at the top, I don't know if Pep Guardiola's called gaffer. He might just be Pep, but wow. You know, that's Pep, you know what I mean? So I'm not that, and that's the difference. But I just thought that needed to happen. And I don't think I could have done it on the first day. I might have lost the group, although we almost went down. We might have gone down if I'd have got them to call me gaffer in that first season, I don't know. But I just had to do it my way. And I think everyone's different. I think some players could come in and say, right, I'm the gaffer, this is it, and shut the door. And I've always been open, and I think one of my big things is relationships with people, no matter if it was teammates, friends, family, or manager to players now. I think one of my biggest strengths is relationships and having those. And I think if I'd come in and gone, right, this, you know, school teacher right from day one, I don't think I'd be sat here now. I think I've done it the right way, but I think I got away with skin of my teeth on that second season. I honestly do. But I'm glad it happened. So I can't complain. It's the path I've done, and to still be sat here, I'm really proud, really humble, and more than anything, really happy.
And you've gone on to, since those first struggles, you know, based on the budgets, etc., you know, you seem to overachieve from the outset. What do you have to do to overachieve in those situations, to get a team who, you know, flirting with relegation in League Two to where you are now, third in League One?
Budget is big. It does help, you know. I'm not going to lie. We didn't have the greatest funds.
But you still don't for League One level, so you still seem to be overachieving.
No, I think that... Do you know, I think the things we've talked about of the relationship with the players will go that extra mile for me. They'll do that extra bit for me. And to have that as a manager, you know, I think he's awesome, because if you do put a system in place, or you do put some tactics in place, and they don't go perfectly right, and somebody breaks through your line or they try something different, if you've got players who are going to do the extra mile for you and think, God, Gaffer, you were wrong there, but I'm going to do this for you and make up for it. And they never say that, they don't say, but they just do it. I think that's the difference, you know. I think that the group we have, I'm hoping that, you know, every manager will probably say, yeah, they go that extra mile, but these lot really, they do, you know. It's the culture in that dressing room is phenomenal. It really is. The leaders, we work really hard on getting characters in. We work so hard on getting the right characters in. That was one of the things after that second year. In charge, that we said, myself, Richard Dobson, who's a fantastic coach, by the way, we work really hard. We bring as many people as we can. We watch as many videos as we can, go and watch them live as we can. If anyone chucks their arms up in the air, or anyone doesn't chase a bad pass, or anyone has an argument with a teammate, so it's a red flag for us, you know, no matter how good they are. And I think staying consistent to that has been important. I think getting the right characters in has been important, and I think a little bit of luck in that dressing room. You know, the Akin Feng was of the world, the Bloomfields of the world, Jacobsons, my generals, they run that dressing room. And I think you've got to look after your generals will look after your dressing room. I just seem to have the right mix at the moment, you know, and it's not going to stay like this. It's bound to be a downturn, bound to be, because that's football. But it's how we deal with that at the moment. Everything's rosy at the moment, going well. But it's how we deal with when it goes down. And I think we deal with it quite well. I think we really do. I think we're strong. We've got some good characters. We give them the tools to dig deep. We do things a little bit differently here. We do the development days. We do, you know, we get them psychologically. We got them all personalities looked at, and what types we've got here, how we need to, what types we need, how the mix is. You know, we don't just... we don't just chuck a squad together and think that's the best squad we've got. Let's pick the best 11 and get out there. I think the blend and everything. We work hard, you know, we really do. And I think that's come from right from the first question in the interview. You know, I think that was it's been there. These lot of my staff will work hard for me. I ask them to do anything, they'll do it for me. But I never ask them to do something I wouldn't do. We've carried sprinklers out in the mornings. We've filled rabbit holes in with and this is before training. And this is not this is recently in the last couple of weeks. I've gone to the pitch. There's a rabbit dug a hole, and we still haven't got the funds to go right. Our groundsmen, they're great. The pitches are great, but we can't afford to have someone up here 24/7 filling rabbit holes in or picking fox dew off the pitch and that. So we do it in the mornings, and I'll do it. I'm not bothered. I look for the balls after training because we haven't got a youth team to pick the balls up after, and you shouldn't do that anyway. But some clubs will have their academy go and get all the gear in. We'll get it all in ourselves, the staff, you know. And I think that just gives us this solid base, this solid work ethic that everyone has to work. They have to perform. And when things don't go right, going that little bit of an extra, giving that little bit extra, that extra mile, I think that's been key to us overachieving. It really has, you know. And long may it continue, because we have this potential investment coming in. The American people have come over, and Rob Keurig potentially wants to get involved with this. If I can get a bit more and overachieve, that means hopefully a lot more for the club. We're not going to change. We've said we've had meetings. We're not going to change what Wickham is. Just might be able to get the bigger talent, you know, some more talent. But they've got to be the right characters, and I won't sacrifice talent for attitude, you know. And that's something that I'll stick by.
You said there how you sort of identify characters, but how do you look after those characters? You know, your likes of, you know, your Akinfenwas, your Bloomfields, your Jacobsons. How do you have to take care of them so that they continue to, like you said, look after the dressing room and help inspire the next sort of generals to come through?
I think total respect from me. I will give them total respect, because that's back to what I say, you treat how you want to be treated. I will give them so much respect. I'll give them information. I'll talk to them all the time. I'll keep them involved to a level higher than probably some of the younger players who don't need to know these things. You know, that they'll get a higher level of information. They'll get explanations if they're not playing themselves. Because I've left Bale out a few times this season. I mean, one of the great moments this season, and it's not just this season, since he's been here, we've played with a quicker front line at times this season. And Bale won't mind me saying he's not the quickest. He's not the one who does the quick front line. No, he's what he is. He's fantastic what he is. But when I play with a quick counter-attacking front line, Akinfenwa doesn't feature sometimes. So I tell him maybe on a Thursday before the video, before I start talking about how we're going to be and what I want to put in place this week, I speak to Bale, put him in the office, and I'll explain. I give him the respect to explain to him. And he might say, I disagree, but I'm behind you, Gaffer. I think I should play. I'm in a good place. I say, yeah, that's great, but this is what I want to try, because this is what I feel will win the game. So this is on a Thursday. So then on a Thursday, we'll go out and do the shape. He'll be coming up to me saying, which player do you want me to be in the opposition? Because they haven't got anyone up front like me. Do you want me to be this midfielder and I'll try and do what he does? So he's now saying, I want to give the starting 11 the best chance of winning on Saturday. And then on the Friday, when I name the team, Akinfenwa knows he's not in the team, and he'll have a look around to see whose head goes down, and he'll get him and he'll walk around the pitch and tell him how to keep their heads up. And he's not playing. Akinfenwa's not playing himself, but he's there picking the other boys up. And I'm thinking, that's special, you know. That is really special. Is it something I would have done? Possibly, you know. But to have that strength from one of your peers is so much stronger than from the manager saying. So these are little examples of the culture we have here, led by. And Matt Bloomfield would do the same. And I really mean that. I'll often say to him, look, just have a look out for him, because he hasn't played for a couple of weeks. Just head check. And that's the way I do it. And I think it's great. And the day I lose those people, I may struggle to get new ones, but we're always trying to develop these generals and the way we do things. And as I say, I don't think there's a bigger message to anyone than from your peers. I think your peers, your people who are actually doing the same as you, they can talk to you on a level. The manager is always going to make the decision whether you like him, not like him, whatever. And we have regular head checks here. We have regular meetings with our generals, making sure that our squad check's good. And I'm hoping all teams do it, and I'm sure they do. But we pride ourselves on that.
I suppose what's helped you is having that time to develop those people and to understand how important they are to the dressing room. Is that something you've benefited from, you think?
I think they know how important they are. You know, that's a great statement because they are on and off the pitch. And as footballers, you always think you're important on the pitch. I don't think too many think they're important off the pitch, but believe me, they are. You know, as a manager now, looking, and maybe I look back at my career and think, I could have even done better. I could have even done better off the pitch for people, for managers. Maybe I should have. But I was never one to go banging on the doors about not playing or anything. I never really did that. I think I did it once or twice in my whole career. And that's the truth, you know. I thought, right, have a look at yourself. What can you do better to get in the team? And I'm hoping, again, that sort of stuff pays off with the way I manage, the way I get the best out of my boys. But I'm lucky to have those players, those generals in the dressing room. But they know they're important. And I think, you know, he's 37 now, Bale, but he's still as effective as ever. And Matt Bloomfield's having the season of his life, you know. And Jacobson scored a hat-trick from left-back the other week. So there's not a bad three there at the moment. But they are very important to me, and they deserve as much credit as anyone for what we're doing here.
How much... It's a weird sort of question in a way, but how important do you think it is that you spend so much time, though, committed to the job? We see you today, you know, coming in, no one else is really here. You're coming in on effectively what you're giving the players a day off, you know, working hour after hour at this club. How important is it to spend that time focusing on things, especially in your situation? How important is it that you have, that you lead from the top and sort of like let that information filter down, if you know what I mean?
Do you know what? I'd have the day off if I thought it was relevant for me and my family. I would. I'd take it, you know, if the work-life balance thing is very, very important to me. My family is so important to me. My football is very important, but it's not the most important thing in the world, you know, and that's the truth for me. And I think having that helps me work smart. Work hard, but work smart and know what I'm doing it for. And I'm doing it for the love of it, but also I'm supporting my family as well, which is so important to me. And I think my work-life balance is pretty good. I have a great family to be able to go and do my extra bits. And obviously, I still do the music once a week. I'm out rehearsing and I'm still playing football as well, which I'm sure we'll come to in a minute. But when I can spend time with my family, I will. That's the priority, you know, because I think it keeps me sane. It also keeps me hungry. You can't do this all the time. You can't do it all the time. Yeah, I'm here on my day off, but I won't be here Wednesday when the players, their official day off is usually a Wednesday. I won't be. I'll make sure that I have my downtime. I might have the odd email or the odd phone call, but I'll definitely... get my work done when I'm in. Work smart, I think, rather than just work every hour that's sent to you. You have to look at the videos. You have to watch the next opponents, review the video, the footage you've had. But I've got a good team as well. I won't be trying to do everything. In the early days, I think I tried to do everything. I tried to coach. I tried to look at the opposition. I tried to review the team on Saturday. And there's just not enough hours in the day, you know. There isn't. And then have all the relationships. And then go and rehearse with the band and go and play on Sunday League football. It wasn't enough days in the week, believe me. And I think that having a great team, my sports scientist is a B licensed coach. My assistant manager, Richard Dobson, is fantastic. I have total faith in my physio. They all get on with their jobs without any pressure from me. I can have a day and say, Dobbo, take the team with total trust that it will be the right session, the right way we do things here. And I think that's important as well. So it's sort of a little bit of give and take. And they have a day off today because I may call them next week and say, look, I just need to watch that video with my analyst. can you do this session, get that done, and that's how we work, you know. So I think we do work hard, but we work smart as well, which is important.
But how do you fit everything in, though? Do you manage to sleep at night? You know, is that
yeah.
is that something you struggle with? Because you seem to be someone who doesn't really switch off no matter what you do. You throw yourself at everything.
I think that's the energy in me. I think I'm an energetic person. I'm lucky to have that in me. I think, you know, some people are like that. The amount of coffee I drink, maybe, but some people are like that. I've always had the energy. I've always had super energy to do anything, and I really will be there for people and help and love getting involved with things, you know. It's just the way I've always been. Sleeping, no, I think in the early days, you know, honestly, I used to wake up with team selection. I don't know if any managers have done it, I don't mind admitting it. I've had dreams about the game or team selection or what you're going to tell this player when he's not playing and he's had a good game. But not so much lately, you know, not so much anymore. It's I think I'm maturing all the time, learning all the time, and the more time I spend with in the company of really good managers. I mean, you know, we had Kenny Jackett on Saturday, and he's having a tough time at Portsmouth at the moment, but wow, if I could have a career like Kenny Jackett's had, I'd be well happy, you know, what a manager that is, you know. So to hear him speaking and dealing with things and you know, lucky enough to have spoke to a lot of really good people in the game and learning from them all the time, never will stop. But also will be me. They won't stop me growing my hair, they won't stop me rocking out with my band, and the only thing that'll stop me playing football still is injuries, and I still love a run out on a Tuesday. It's just, we launched a non-league career with Woodley United lately, so the Sundays had to go because that was more family time for me. But now I'm playing midweek for a Step 6 team, and absolutely love it.
Just tell us how that all came about, though, because you surely don't have time to do that.
I don't train, you know, they train once a week. But I've got friends who I played Sunday League with who went to this club, and they said, look, you'd be great just to come down and play, and you know, we know you could still get it. For some reason, I've still got my pace. I'm 46 years old, and I'm still as quick as I've ever been. Maybe not as has ever been, but I'm still pretty quick, and that always got me through my career, you know. So when that goes, I'll call it a day. But I love the competition. I love just being. I think it's just being a bit normal as well. Sometimes, you know, football's, like I say, it's very important, and I love playing it. I still get the buzz off turning out and putting a shirt on. But you know, my job. I'm really happy in my job. My work-life balance. It's just been a great 7 years. Hope it continues, but you never know what's around the corner. But I don't think I've got a football career anymore. I think I might have to look at something else.
You still join in at the five sides of training?
Now and again, less so than in recent years. In recent years, I've had to. I think my last competitive football game for Wickham was at 43. I came a sub in a. And I think it was the checker trade then in the trophy, you know, because we didn't have enough players to fill the bench. I wanted to rest some legs for the Saturday. And that was my last one. It's not a bad age to get to, but, you know, some good players out there now, especially at Wickham, so I don't embarrass myself as much as I did anymore. But I tell you what, I'm still the best crosser at the club, I'll tell you that.
fantastic. And coming back to the club as well, third in the league, beat Portsmouth at the weekend. I think you're 1 point off top. How far can you take it? How can you take this club to the Championship, you think?
I'd like to be able to take it. At the moment, we're not able to, I think, with finances. I think just around the corner is the size of the squad being smaller because of injuries, suspensions, whatever it is. You know, I've been in the game long enough to know that does happen. We've got a bit more depth this season, without a doubt. Rob Kuig, the American, has come in. At the start of the season, it looked really, really grim with the budget being cut because the club's losing money every year. How and why that happens, I don't think we should argue about. I think the real reason is that the amount of money in football now is that You need a benefactor in there. You need someone who's gonna give you a bit, just a chance. Rob's got this. Rob's got this this desire to come into Wickham and help us out. And we have a vote coming up to try and get him into the club and I think owning the club to to invest some money. I think it'd be super exciting if that happens, and that would give us the ability to have a look at the next level. But at the moment, I think there's a ceiling, and it's finances. And we look at Bury and Bolton and what's happened there in recent years, you know, and recent months. And I know there's different situations, and I'm not qualified enough to look at their accounts and work out exactly what's happened. But I'll tell you now that I'll be able to name the top four teams in the Premier League this year, and they'll be probably the ones with the most money and the biggest ability to pay the top players. And I'm sure Sunderland and Portsmouth and Ipswich won't be far off the top of our league either. And again, bigger clubs tend to be at the top end. Even though Portsmouth have had a sticky start, I'm sure they'll be up there. Money talks in football, unfortunately, because I'm as purist as anyone, and I'd love the fairy tales. And I was that lad who, you know, never had a schoolboy, just went into it and got up there. So fairy tales are important to me, but I think that.
Leicester one now,
I think it's a good few years since that. People don't realise that it's still quite strong in the memory, but it must be, what, four seasons ago now? So it's gone like that. And, you know, the other teams are dominating. In my opinion, it's the way it is. And for this club to have a chance of that next level, I think we're going to need someone to come in and help out in the finance department. But it's been great. It's been a great ride, you know. This achieving and underdog and above what we should do. And I've still got a poster in my office that's from a magazine, a well-known magazine that has Wycombe Wanderers second bottom of League One this season predictions. And that'll stay
that
up there.
That motivates you.
That motivates me.
In terms of, like you mentioned there, in terms of that, the ambition and the ceiling. But if this club gets, you know, like you said, mentioned there, potential money coming in. If this club can match your ambition, is this where you see your future potentially working on this project, continuing this project?
Absolutely. You know, if this club has ambition to be in the next level, I actually think that the level above that, the Premier League, is now, it's becoming a different sport almost. You know, it's so polished. The game is so. I mean, the Championship's fantastic. It's the fifth biggest watched league in the world, I think, now, which is phenomenal, you know, and we should be so proud of that. But that Premier League, wow, something else, isn't it? It's amazing. Now, to be there and to see the likes of you, Chris Wilders, Eddie Howes, Sean Dash, it just inspires me that there is that chance, that tiny chance, but they all took their clubs up, they all went up with their clubs, you know, and Little Wickham is going to be tough. So the Championship is probably realistically where I'd love to try and get this club. I would love to have the chance to get this club. And that's the aim, you know. I was lucky enough to play probably the majority of my career in the Championship. It's a fantastic division. And it's almost the Premier League now. You look at the teams in there. Yeovil did it, you know. Burton did it. And I think there is that chance still of the fairy tale from League One to Championship, but I think winning the Premier League now is wow, that's some league now. So we can do it, but we need the ability to do it, and that's sort of the equation we need to sort out.
And for you recently, you know, blinked with the Lincoln job, obviously, you know, strong links there in terms of your playing career. What was that like for you, being linked with that job? Was it a bit of a distraction for you in terms of the work you've done this season? So a tiny bit of a blip, considering the fantastic start you've had, yeah, when you were linked, yeah, to the job. I think it's unfair to sort of say it was a blip looking,
yeah,
at your expectations.
I don't think we can put that game down to the link. The timing looked like it, you know. But do you know, if I'm being totally honest, I think everybody knows that. I want to try and have a go higher, definitely. I want to manage higher. And it'd have to be something special to leave this club, you know. Opportunity-wise, finance-wise, you know, I'm not going to hide and say, oh, of course it is, looking after your family and things is important. But to be able to do it here, to have the ability to try it here, would be my preferred option because of what we've built here, and probably because of the 7 years, you know, of management it would be fantastic to have a go at it. We're sort of having a go now, but like I say, this is going to be tough. This league's going to be very, very tough, you know. With the injuries I picked up on Saturday, and one or two knocks we've had earlier in the season, I might just about be able to fill the bench on Saturday with nobody else, believe me. And that'll include a lad who hasn't even played for the first team yet. So that will be us, you know. And then you pick up any more injuries, you're starting to lose players off the bench. And that's where we are. People don't realise it. We've got the strongest squad we've ever had. We've got more depth than we've ever had, but we're still, resource-wise, very small in this division. So we do need that better, without a doubt. And so my preferred option would be the ability to do it with Wycombe Wanderers. But I'm hoping no one would begrudge if a fantastic opportunity came that I'd have a look at that as well, because I've got some real driving ambition to have a go in the league above this one.
Would it have to be football? Could it be a music ambition that you could go for, something, you know?
Well, if you could tell me a band that's over 40 that have smashed it into the charts or started a music career, then I'd
Rolling Stones still going.
Where they started when they were teenagers. That boat might have sailed, you know. In my head, when I'm on stage and singing, then I am Mick Jagger, but I don't think that's a realistic thing. I'd love to be able to get some songs out, some of our songs out, some of the songs we've written, and just have them listened to. And it almost be like that, being sold for money as a player. Somebody actually paying money to listen to our songs would be cool. Maybe I'm being a bit greedy there, but now, the music's always played a big part, you know, from mum, you know, being a singer when we were growing up. She was a professional singer, and that's how she earned a living. So that always stayed with me and always will be in me, but maybe I'll leave that one to the kids now.
Well, it's certainly been a rock and roll start to the to the season, Gareth. Thanks very much for joining us. We do appreciate it on the official EFL podcast. And congratulations once again, 7 years at the football club. No mean feat, that. And yeah, and good luck for the rest of the season.
Thanks very much.
The official EFL podcast, the best reaction to all the match action, available every week.